Jones is on up. Kim Colter is a local AD interviewer. He works in the Attorney General for the Athens.
Just a minute. All right, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Doug Hastings, and I represent appellant Dante Lamar Jones. Oral argument will be given by my co-counsel Duke McCall, who has admitted pro hoc vice in this case.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Duke McCall for Dante Jones. In this appeal, Dr. Lamar Jones found his sentence as a juvenile based on the U.S. Supreme Court.
Excuse me, the clock isn't running. Excuse me. The clock isn't running. Thank you.
Your Honor, in this appeal, Dante Lamar Jones found his sentence as a juvenile based on the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in Millard, Alabama. Supreme Court held in Millard. The 8th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution forbids a sentencing scheme that mandates the imposition of life without possible parole for juvenile homicide offenders and requires an individualized consideration for mitigating the cause of youth for such offenders. Dante Jones was sentenced as a juvenile to life in prison without possible parole, without an individualized consideration for mitigating the cause of youth under the Virginia statute.
Do you claim that he received a mandatory minimum sentence?
Your Honor, there was only one sentencing option for the court, and that was a sentence of imprisonment for life.
What about the judge's ability to suspend part of that sentence?
Your Honor, the Commonwealth does argue in response that pursuant to 19.2-303, that a court may suspend all or a portion of the sentence, but that does not satisfy the dictates of Miller. The requirement is that the court must consider mitigating points of view. Moreover, it's undisputed that in this case, the court did not. Mr. Jones was not afforded an individualized consideration of the mitigating clause of his youth that they could have required pursuant to Miller.
The way I understood the Miller case was that those requirements kicked into place if there was a mandatory life sentence.
Your Honor, it is correct. The court's holding in Miller was that the 8th Amendment forbids a sentencing scheme that mandates life in prison without the possibility of parole for juvenile homicide offenders.
So I guess Justice Goodwin's question, and I have the same question, is under our scheme in Virginia, it's technically not mandatory because of the ability of the trial judge to actually suspend if he or she chooses to do so. And there are other instances in Virginia where it very clearly says mandatory life sentence, and we've got a definition of what that means.
Your Honor, if the mandatory minimum provision that the court is referring to does prevent a court from suspending a sentence, that language is not contained in 18.2-10A. There is no mandatory minimum. The court does have the ability to suspend. My assertion, Your Honor, is that that does not satisfy the requirements of the ability of the court. The provision that the court may suspend does not satisfy the requirement in Miller that the court must conduct an individualized consideration of mitigating clause.
I agree with that, but as I understood Miller, it's a mandatory, when it's mandatory. So how does our scheme fit within the rubric of mandatory?
Because it only allows for one sentence and does not require an individualized consideration of mitigating clause. That renders the sentence imposed, imprisonment for life, mandatory.
Okay, I think I understand your answer.
I'm not sure if I understand. Miller says if it's mandatory, then it is unconstitutional. You have to use the individual sentencing factors. If it's mandatory, but we're asking the question, if Virginia's statute is not mandatory, does Miller even apply?
If the scheme were not mandatory, if it allowed for a sentence other than imprisonment for life, then if that were the case, which we submit it is not the case, if it were the case, then Miller would not apply. If, for example, this were a Class 2 felony that allowed for a sentence in the range of 20 years to life, then Miller would not apply.
So I think your position really is that the provisions that allows for it to be suspended doesn't make it non-mandatory.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Okay. But if we rule otherwise, then it takes us out of the purview of Miller.
Your Honor, I agree that if the court were to rule that that satisfied Miller, then that would take it out of the purview of Miller, but I disagree that that would satisfy Miller.
I understand that.
The court is explicit that, in its language, it states that at least twice, that its holding requires the court to conduct individualized consideration of the game law to view the ability of the court, provision in 19.2-3, that the court may suspend portion of all and not require the court to conduct the individualized consideration of the game qualities required by Miller. The requirements of Miller are analogous in this regard to the assessment required in a death penalty case. The court must conduct consideration of mitigating evidence, must conduct consideration of aggravating factors, and must conduct that inquiry. The ability of the court is not sufficient for the court to have the power to do that. It's not that it may do that, it must do that. And that is our position. The same doctrine and construct applies in this case under Miller. The court must conduct this consideration, individualized consideration of mitigating clause of use. If it does not do that, it does not satisfy Miller. The ability of the court to suspend was an argument raised by Arkansas in the Hunter Jackson case, which is a companion case for the court of Miller. The court did not find that sufficient for sorts of arguments.
Well, they found that they didn't argue it in the lower court.
They didn't reject it outright. You're correct, Your Honor, but what they found was that the court treated it as if it were mandatory. And they found the court's treatment of the sentence as if it were mandatory to be binding upon the court. They would not consider the first time on appeal suspension argument that's pretty the state potentially may not be able to do.
What significance, if any, should we give to his plea agreement and his guilty plea? It seems to me that there is authority that for the proposition that if he has entered a guilty plea, then he has waived the ability to bring this action under Miller.
Your Honor, the guilty plea is limited to its term. It is binding upon the defendant just as it is binding on the Commonwealth. The waiver of the guilty plea was limited to feeling of guilt. It did not extend to... did not waive the right to challenge the sentence, specifically did not waive his right to challenge.
He agreed to the sentence.
He agreed to the sentence to avoid the death penalty, but he did not waive. The limited waiver in the guilty plea does not extend to a sentence, does not extend to a collateral challenge of a sentence, does not specifically extend to an Eighth Amendment challenge to a sentence after the fact.
It seems to me that Brady versus U.S. says exactly the opposite. It seems to me that Brady's, in the context of that case, we find no requirement in the Constitution that a defendant must be permitted to disown his solemn admissions in open court, even if the statute under which he was convicted is eventually set aside, because later judicial decisions indicate that the plea rested on a faulty premise.
Your Honor, I don't think Brady is on point. I've gone to blank on specific facts in Brady, but I think that dealt with the guilt and the waiver of the right to appeal the guilt. And that was waived by Mr. Jones in his plea agreement, but he did not waive his right to challenge his sentence. The Fourth Circuit has stated and repeatedly that the terms of the plea agreement are to be construed strictly against the Commonwealth. In this case, the Commonwealth...
Actually, he was asking that his sentence be set aside, because the death penalty sentence that had previously been in place had been ruled unconstitutional. He said, I entered a plea because I wanted to avoid the death penalty, much like the case here. And the court, as I read the case, said that doesn't matter. You're still held to your plea agreement, even in a habeas context.
Your Honor, I apologize. I do not recall the facts of Brady. I'm happy to take a look at that if I have time left and address that on rebuttal.
Take a look at U.S. versus Mason, the Fourth Circuit, citing Brady for that same position, and an Eastern District of Virginia case, all of them that appear to me to stand for the same position, and Ferris versus Davis.
Your Honor, I am familiar with the Mason case. The Mason case did include an explicit waiver of the right to challenge the sentence, which is not present in the plea agreement that Mr. Jones signed.
So you're saying, but your client agreed to the sentence. So even having agreed to the sentence, you're saying, unless he says, I agree to the sentence and I also agree not to challenge the sentence, that it doesn't matter.
That's correct,
your position.
Your He agreed to the sentence to avoid the death penalty, but he did not waive his right to challenge that sentence at a later date on the grounds that the sentence imposed violated the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment.
I want to ask you something about the jurisdiction of the circuit court. This was brought as a motion to vacate, not a habeas case.
Yes, Your Honor.
And, you know, we all know that the time frame of the 21 days and all those things have long since expired. What gives the circuit court jurisdiction to grant relief on a motion to vacate?
This court's decision involves the Commonwealth.
Well, Rawls involved a sentence that was beyond the statutory range, as I recall.
That's correct, Your Honor. What the court held was that a sentence that is invalid, a void ab initio, may be challenged at any time by virtue of a motion to vacate. The Commonwealth's argument that this is not void ab initio is apprehended. Concept presumes that Miller does not apply retroactively because a sentence that is unconstitutional is void ab initio. Whether or not it's authorized by statute, the court, the nature of the sentence is such that the court does not have the power to enter it. The Illinois Supreme Court addressed this exact same issue recently in dealing with a similar case, Illinois v. Davis, from March 20, 2014. And the court stated in addressing the constitutional not a life sentence under Miller, quote, a sentence that violates the Constitution is void from its inception and may be attacked at any time. That is the principle that this court set forth in Rawls v. Commonwealth.
So I guess, and so in essence, and this happens sometimes, that in order to decide if the circuit court had jurisdiction, we have to decide, one, if our sentencing scheme comes within Miller, two, whether it was waived. We have to decide all the issues on the merits to decide whether, in fact, the circuit court had jurisdiction.
The argument is that he's presenting is that he has the authority to assert a motion to vacate because it's still in the sentence filing.
But to determine the jurisdiction, you always have the authority to determine your jurisdiction, and sometimes to determine that, you have to decide underlying issues on the merits. Because if it's not void ab initio, because our sentencing scheme doesn't come under Miller, the circuit court had no jurisdiction to even go to first base on it.
If the sentence is not void ab initio, and does not apply retroactively, the court concludes, for other reasons, that if it is not void ab initio, then of course the motion to vacate is improper and should be dismissed. The two are inextricably intertwined. I agree, Your Honor.
Okay.
Does the issue of whether something is void ab initio, is that decided as a matter of state law?
Your Honor, I believe it is.
Do we have any Virginia case that stands for the proposition that something that the court could do at the time that it took the action that later becomes perhaps unconstitutional depending on how we apply Miller or not apply Miller is rendered void ab initio, or is our definition of void ab initio something that the court could not do at the time that it did it?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of a case in Virginia that is exactly like this one, is the short answer. There are cases in Virginia holding that a statute that is unconstitutional is void ab initio, and all actions taken pursuant to that statute are void ab initio. And I would argue that that is directly controlling here, that the fact that a statute authorizes a sentence that is unconstitutional renders that sentence void ab initio, just as the statute itself extended it violates the Constitution, is also void ab initio. Turning to the Commonwealth's final argument, the Commonwealth attempts to avoid the obvious import of the Supreme Court's application of the Miller rule in the companion case of Jeff v. Hobbs by arguing that the court did not expressly state that the rule announced in Miller applies to cases on collateral review while actually applying it to the case on collateral review. Justice O'Connor explains in Tyler v. Kane a new rule was made retroactive not merely through express statements, but also through holding that logically dictates the retroactivity of the new rule. The application of the new rule in Jackson logically dictates the retroactivity of that rule.
Isn't it just as logical, and I think the Commonwealth makes this argument, to take the position that because the Attorney General or whoever represented Jackson didn't raise the issue that they waived it? The issue has to be raised, does it not?
I don't think that analysis is consistent with Justice O'Connor's statements about the Kane, Your Honor. I think she says exactly that. The Commonwealth also argues, notwithstanding the court's retroactive application of Miller, it should not be considered retroactive because the rule announced in Miller is a mere procedural rule. The Commonwealth is incorrect on that point. because it prohibits a category of punishment, mandatory life without parole, for a class of offenders, juveniles, because of their status, the chronological age, Miller is the definition of a substantive constitutional rule.
One other question. Would Justice O'Connor's position have been called into question by the fact that I think it's Cadiz, I may not pronounce it right, the court did not apply Padilla to Cadiz subsequently? Wouldn't that call into question the position you just raised?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because that was Justice Kagan who also authored the Miller decision.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is that in that case, she concluded that Padilla did not announce a new rule and therefore did not apply retroactively. Was applying a new rule. That was the issue in that case. I think it was crystal clear in Miller that the court was adopting a new rule and was applying it retroactively to Jackson. One final point I'd like to make, as the U.S. Supreme Court explained, this is Justice Scalia, Shriver v. Summerlin, a holding that a particular fact must be found by a jury who makes the decision is a procedural holding. But making a certain fact essential to the death penalty, as a quote, making a certain fact essential to the death penalty, or in this case, making a certain fact essential to the imposition of a life without parole sentence, is a substantive finding and thus applied retroactively under the U.S. Supreme Court's precedent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Please call Dean Murphy for the Commonwealth. Let me start off with the power to vacate this conviction. There's no question that this sentence, when imposed in 2001, was not void. It is not now void. A sentence of life without parole can still be imposed under Miller. You have to follow different procedures to get there, no question about that. But that's the sentence imposed here is not void, even now. You can still impose on a juvenile life without parole. The difference in Rawls is Rawls said the court couldn't do what it did because what it did was not such as could, that the court had power to render. The court did not have the power to render the sentence that it did in Rawls because it was beyond the statutory maximum. The sentence here is not beyond the statutory maximum. It is still available. So the sentence in and of itself is not anyway void. The question is, did we get to it in this case through the wrong procedure? So I think that in and of itself establishes that we're not talking about a void judgment, a void sentence. This is not the appropriate way to challenge that. There are other ways to challenge it. In fact, Mr. Jones has a proceeding pending in federal court, which has been stayed for this proceeding, where, in fact, he may well get the relief, but where it is, there are no procedural basis at this point to preclude his application in federal court. But here,
Mr. Murphy, if the rule in Miller is substantive, would that make the decision or the sentence void ab initio?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. I think, again, that there are no, as the Mr. Jones' attorney points out, there is no case law in Virginia dealing with this issue. Everything that I've been able to find deals with either something that is still a case that is still pending on appeal when a change occurs. As, of course, I think we did in the court in Mueller versus Murray established that principle from the Supreme borrowing the federal standard that if you're still on direct appeal when a change in the law occurs, you apply that. Or a case like Rawls, where in fact the sentence was improper at that time. We do not have a case that says the sentence was okay when it was imposed, nothing wrong with it, down the road. The courts or the legislature decides that was not the appropriate sentence, changes the sentence, the question of whether it's applied has not been decided. And I think, you know, that there's no reason to assume that every time there's change in the sentence that there is something that you have to apply it retroactively in all cases. And it seems to me that in the absence of that authority, there's no basis in this case to apply, to challenge or to avoid what is in fact still a valid judgment on the face of the order. That is, the order says you are sentenced to life by operation of law, that's without parole, but that is a valid judgment. You cannot say that about the Roth judgment. The Roth judgment was wrong when it was initially entered. But I think,
Let me ask a question about the plea and the plea agreement. Counsel tells me that the authorities that I've cited have no applicability because in those cases the appellant was challenging his sentence, which he had not agreed to not challenge.
Well, I'm not sure that's true. If you look at page 44 of the appendix, what the defendant agrees is to waive any and all right to appeal with regard to any substantive or procedural issue involved in this process. That seems to me to apply also to sentencing issues. In any event, I mean, the real question is, in this case, having pled guilty, among other things, what the defendant petitioner precluded from happening was the individualized sentencing that he says is missing here. In his plea agreement, he agreed to a specific sentence of life without parole. The judge accepted the plea agreement and imposed that sentence. So we can't say that because in this case he didn't get individualized punishment, somehow Miller applies because he pled guilty. On the guilty plea, I think it's no question that you generally waive most issues of this nature. He agreed to this sentence, and I would suggest that under Mason and Contreras and Brary, which of course has already Brady, which was already cited, you can't agree to something and then later on down the road when there's a change in the law say, I want my plea back, I don't want to have to accept what I had before.
Well, if you don't know about a particular right, can you waive it? Is that a knowing and voluntary waiver?
Well, yes, you can certainly waive any challenge. You can waive any.
I know that. That's not my question. Can you waive a constitutional right about which you were not aware because the particular understanding of that was new?
You can certainly waive a right, a general right. That is, if he could have raised an Eighth Amendment claim at this time, he could have said that life without parole is improper, and under the Eighth Amendment, as was subsequently raised in here. He, of course, could have at that point have raised the court's subsequent interpretation, but I don't think you are somehow relieved from your waiver because there was a subsequent change in the law. Well, at least I don't know of any case to that effect.
Yeah, aren't those the facts of Brady? Am I misunderstanding my facts of Brady? He was subject to the death penalty. He chose a plea because he didn't want the death penalty. The law was subsequently changed to make the death penalty in that case unconstitutional.
I think what it says that the maximum penalty at the time of the plea agreement was assumed to be less than it was, and later on determined that he was incorrect. All parties were incorrect in their assessment, and they said you aren't entitled to release your plea in that particular remedy. But I think, what we go back to also is whether or not this is a Miller state. And the court's already addressed this. Importantly, the statutes for child rape, for instance, have a mandatory minimum of life in prison. That's absent here. There's clearly power to suspend. I think the defendant...
Counsel, are you aware of any case where a juvenile defendant accused of capital murder was given a life sentence and some portion of it was suspended?
There are no reported cases. There's one case that I've heard of, but I'm not. It's just some mentioned, but I'm not sure what would actually happen. I don't know of any. I can't present to the court that has happened. But the point of Miller is mandatory. It doesn't mean if it is possible to reduce the sentence in the jail from life. Miller does not apply. We have a situation here where I think the defendant, or the petitioner, concedes that the sentence can be suspended. course, as I said before, the reason it wasn't suspended here, or couldn't have been suspended here, is because the defendant agreed to a specific sentence. So what we have, and the Clem case in the district court accepted that thinking, that in fact there is a provision in 19.2303 to suspend any sentence. Now, of course, then 18.212.1 says no, that right does not exist when you have in the statute that it is a mandatory minimum. So in the absence of a statement about the crime being punished with a mandatory minimum, the court is free to suspend the sentence. If that is available, we do not have mandatory life without parole. We have life must be the sentence, but it can be suspended. I think that's what's different. Now, in Arkansas, the Arkansas court, the Arkansas Attorney General did try to raise this issue in the United States Supreme Court, but the court said, well, wait a minute, you didn't raise this below. And in fact, in the state courts, you and everybody else treated it as if this was mandatory. We're not in that situation yet. This court has never spoken on this issue, and it's free to do so now and say that Virginia's law is not mandatory. Now,
have we treated it as if it was? Have we treated it as if it was?
No, we have not treated it at all. We haven't really decided anyway. Well, we have many judges may think that it is mandatory. I mean, that perception may be out there. But I think a quick look at the law indicates that the legislature certainly didn't make it clear, as it has done with many other statutes, that there is no suspension. You know, there are, I think we cited a couple dozen statutes where they have said mandatory minimum, which means no suspension. That does not apply to the death penalty case. Now, with respect to, if you get down and want to decide whether Miller is retroactive, the first argument is that, well, because the companion case of Jackson versus Hobbs applied Miller, therefore, Miller is now applicable to all habeas cases. Well, first of all, I wanted to point out that wasn't argued by the authorities in Jackson, the defendant in Jackson, in the state of Jackson. And additionally, Chydez, which discussed Padilla's applicability, Padilla itself was a habeas case. In Padilla, the court ruled that you could be found ineffective for not properly advising a defendant of the immigration effects of his guilty plea. Chydez came along in another habeas and said, okay, we'd like to apply Padilla to our case. The court said, no. Well, that makes it clear that the mere fact that it was announced in a habeas case somehow means that all subsequent habeas cases permit the application under Teague. The Teague is no longer involved. It's that in fact, from now on, always retroactive in all habeas cases. That is not the rule in the Supreme Court, and I think that the rule is that there has to be individual later determination that it is applicable to habeas. Now, if you think about the next step, which of course is Teague, the easiest way to look at this case at that point is to read Miller itself. And what Miller said was that this case, our decision, as the first discussed Roper and Graham. Roper said no death penalty for juveniles. Graham said no life without parole for juveniles for non-homicide offenses. The court then said in Miller, our decision does not categorically bar a penalty for a class of offenders or type of crime, as in Roper or Graham. Instead, it mandates only that a sentencer follow a certain process. So what it says, we are not categorically changing the law with respect to what sentence can be imposed or who it can be imposed upon. We are saying that this sentence, in this case, has to be imposed in a different way, that the sentencer has to follow a certain process. Seems to me it couldn't be clearer that what the court is talking about is a procedure. And procedures are not generally applied retroactively. That's the rule in Teague, is that there are two exceptions. Teague says no retroactivity in collateral proceedings unless it is a substantive change or watershed change. Clearly it's not substantive, it's a procedural change. It tells the courts how they have to consider application of life without parole. And it tells them these are the procedures you have to follow, and it does not limit. Life without parole is still available for juveniles, it's just how you go about doing it. And it seems to me for those reasons, for all of many reasons, the circuit court was correct in not granting the request for relief. Thank you.
Thank you. You used all your time. I think you, yeah. Court is adjourned until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.